thing, and I can assure you of that," he said. 5 months later, the department made headlines when its DHS-funded drone accidentally crashed into its DHS-funded Bearcat. Lenko's Massery told me he was certain that the Keene protesters' efforts would ultimately be in vain. "We have Bearcats in 90% of the 100 or so largest cities in America," Massery said. "This is going to happen. It has already happened. To resist now would be like saying police officers should scrap the Glock and go back to the revolver. It's a fantasy." Massery was right. In November 2012, Lenko accepted its check from DHS and delivered a shiny new Bearcat to the town of Keene. On November 2, 2002, a large group of police officers in tactical gear descended on a rave party in Racine, Wisconsin. The cops kicked in doors, dragged young people from bathroom stalls, threw others to the floor, and held dozens more at gunpoint. The police issued more than 450 citations of $968 each to partygoers merely for attending an event where some attendees were breaking the state's drug laws. Only three people were arrested on actual drug charges. With help from the ACLU, the city of Racine eventually dismissed the charges against all attendees who hadn't yet pleaded guilty. The trendy new drug throwing the media and politicians into hysterics was ecstasy. Raves were the new, weird and different dance parties where teenagers were allegedly taking this crazy sex drug. Cue the moral panic, political grandstanding, and ensuing aggressive crackdown. Prior to the raid in Racine, Senator Joe Biden of Delaware seemed particularly obsessed with rave parties. Politicians seemed to think that any party with techno music, pulsing lights, and neon inevitably degenerated into underage kids getting high on ecstasy and engaging in mass orgies. In the summer of 2002, Biden was pushing his Rave Act, an absurdly broad law that would have made venue and club owners liable for running a drug operation if they merely sold the paraphernalia common to parties where people took ecstasy, accessories like bottled water and glow sticks. After attempting to sneak the bill through Congress with various parliamentary maneuvers, Biden was finally able to get a slightly modified version folded into the bill that created the Amber Alert for missing children. Once again, a politician had demagogued worries over a mostly harmless drug into a climate of fear. And once again, that fear led to aggressive, wholly disproportionate crackdowns across the country. A few years later, one of the rave raids was captured on video. In August 2005, more than 90 police officers from several state and local SWAT teams raided 1,500 people at a peaceful outdoor dance party in Spanish Fork Canyon, Utah. The police were armed with assault weapons, full SWAT attire, police dogs, and tear gas. Many in attendance say that police beat, abused, and swore at partygoers. Police denied the allegations, though amateur video audio clearly showed the police barking out orders punctuated with profanity. In truth, the party appeared to have been pretty well run. Private security guards had been stationed outside the event and confiscated any illegal drugs they found on attendees. The raiding SWAT cops then arrested the private security guards for the drugs they had confiscated and charged them with possession. The other new concept at work in Racine and Spanish Fork was the willingness to subject large groups of people to commando tactics in hopes of catching even a few offenders. By the late 2000s, SWAT teams were increasingly called out to raid entire bars and nightclubs for drug activity. A search warrant for a bar's owner or a description of the place as a drug market could allow police to go in and give the SWAT treatment to everyone inside. And it wasn't just bars and nightclubs that were treated this way. In November 2003, police in Goose Creek, South Carolina, raided an entire high school, conducting a blanket commando-style raid on Stratford High School. Students were ordered at gunpoint to lie face down on the floor while police searched their lockers and persons for drugs. Some were handcuffed, while canine units deployed dogs to search their lockers, backpacks, and bodies. Oddly, media reports indicated that the school had a stellar academic reputation. Laquan Simpson, a 14-year-old, was forced to kneel at gunpoint. His father had once served on a SWAT team. "They hit that school like it was a crack house," he said, "like they knew that there were crack dealers in there armed with guns." The raid was based on a tip from the school's principal that a single student might have been selling pot. The raid turned up no illicit drugs, and the police made no arrests. Still, though these raids of schools and parties were somewhat new, drug cops had been conducting massive drug sweeps of entire neighborhoods for years, subjecting innocent people to violent tactics simply because of where they happened to live. There were more of those police actions, too. In February 2002, for example, 100 Durham police officers, 2 National Guard helicopters, and 10 North Carolina Bureau of Investigation agents seized an entire neighborhood on Cheek Road, then engaged in a series of forced entry drug raids. They called the whole episode Operation TAPS, short for the Aggressive Police Strategy. The police arrested 35 people and confiscated an undisclosed amount of drugs, plus 2 pistols. Superior Court Judge Orlando Hudson later threw out all the arrests and evidence, ruling that the entire operation was unconstitutional and partially illegal, and that some of the officers' behavior amounted to criminal conduct. One particularly aggressive action, peppered with war rhetoric, occurred in April 2006, when police in Buffalo, New York, staged a series of drug raids throughout the city under the moniker Operation Shock and Awe. They borrowed the phrase from the U.S. military, which had used it to describe its strategy in the early days of the Iraq War. Shock and Awe in Buffalo meant 38 SWAT raids over 3 days. The cops even invited along a couple of reporters from the Buffalo News to cover the invasion. A month later, the Buffalo News ran a follow-up report. The original 6 pounds of marijuana police claimed to have found was actually 4 pounds, 13 ounces. 3.5 pounds of that came by way of an unrelated traffic stop on the same day that had nothing to do with the raids. They found all of 5 guns. Not surprisingly, the revised haul wasn't enough contraband to keep the 78 people in jail. 16 were immediately released with no criminal charges. Another 32 were out of jail within 24 hours due to insufficient evidence. City leaders were furious, not because city police had just terrorized innocent people with fruitless SWAT raids, but because so many petty offenders were let off. City officials demanded tougher drug laws and discussed the possibility of sending drug cops and SWAT teams out with housing code inspectors to clean up suspected crack houses without those pesky Fourth Amendment warrant requirements. Buffalo's chief of detectives, Dennis Richards, told the newspaper that Operation Shock and Awe was just the beginning. "There will certainly be more raids in the future," he said. "You can count on that. We're looking at small-scale, large-scale, street-level. We're looking at top to bottom." In the 2000s, the U.S. Supreme Court somehow managed to inflict more damage on the already crippled Castle Doctrine. It began with United States versus Banks. In 1998, a raid team in North Las Vegas knocked and announced themselves while serving a drug warrant. The suspect was in the shower at the time and claimed he didn't hear them. They waited an estimated 15 to 20 seconds, then forced their way inside. The search turned up illicit drugs and illegal weapons. In 2003, the Supreme Court unanimously ruled that 15 to 20 seconds is sufficient time for police to wait after knocking before forcing entry, though they conceded that it was a close call. The search warrant for Banks was served on a Wednesday afternoon, a time of day when 15 to 20 seconds might seem like enough time. But a warrant served at night, while everyone is asleep, most likely in a bedroom removed from the front door, where bedrooms usually are, would be quite a bit different. The opinion, written by Justice David Souter, made no such distinction. Souter also indicated that even shorter wait times might be justified in narcotics cases because of the disposableness of the evidence. Here again, a U.S. Supreme Court opinion had taken a position that makes it easier to use violent, dynamic entry tactics on low-level drug offenders than major ones, because smaller quantities are easier to destroy than larger ones, and for nonviolent offenses like drugs or gambling, where the incriminating evidence is generally disposable, than for crimes like weapons violations or murder, guns and bodies being tougher to destroy quickly. By Souter's analysis, what matters is the opportunity to get rid of cocaine, which a prudent dealer will keep near a commode or kitchen sink. The significant circumstances include the arrival of the police during the day, when anyone inside would probably have been up and around, and the sufficiency of 15 to 20 seconds for getting to the bathroom or the kitchen to start flushing cocaine down the drain. It is imminent disposal, not travel time to the entrance, that governs when the police may reasonably enter. As discussed earlier, the knock-and-announce rule arose out of the common law tradition and the Castle Doctrine valued so highly by the American founders. To protect the sanctity of the home, the police were obligated to give a homeowner the opportunity to grant them entrance in order to prevent a violent confrontation, the destruction of his door and property, and the infliction of terror upon him and his family. Souter's direction to the police to consider disposal time instead of the time it would take an occupant to come to the door not only does away with the notion that the purpose of the knock-and-announce rule is to give citizens the opportunity to avoid a violent confrontation, it also presupposes that all drug suspects are guilty. Souter's only concern was with making sure the knock-and-announce requirement doesn't give drug offenders the opportunity to destroy evidence, and every other justice agreed with him. In Banks, a unanimous court decided that preserving the evidence needed to convict people suspected of nonviolent, consensual drug crimes was more important than protecting innocent people from the violence of a paramilitary-style police raid. 30 years after it began, the modern drug war had finally killed the Castle Doctrine. Next up was the 2006 case Hudson v. Michigan, in which the Supreme Court effectively erased its own recognition of the knock-and-announce requirement 10 years earlier. By a 6-3 vote, the court decided that even when police conduct a clearly illegal no-knock raid, any illegal evidence they seize can still be used against the defendant at trial. Writing for the majority, Justice Antonin Scalia took aim at that old conservative nemesis, the exclusionary rule. Scalia wrote that the rule is excessive and inappropriate in such cases. He added that there are other ways of holding police officers accountable when they violate the knock-and-announce requirement. Scalia explained that police management and internal affairs departments could, for instance, bring disciplinary action against offending officers, or innocent victims of illegal raids could sue the offending officers in court. He also cited the existence of civilian review boards. If you've listened this far into this audiobook, it should be clear that those solutions haven't been particularly effective at preventing these abuses. In pointing to these other possible remedies for knock-and-announce violations, Scalia cited the work of criminologist Sam Walker, who has done extensive research on the development of police professionalism. In the study Scalia cited, Walker concluded that there had been enormous progress in the education, training, and supervision of police officers. Scalia argued that this progress was gradually making the exclusionary rule obsolete. But Walker's thesis was that this progress has come about in part because of Supreme Court decisions applying the exclusionary rule, particularly during the Warren years. Walker was horrified. Shortly after the Hudson decision came down, in an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times, headlined, "Thanks for Nothing, Nino." Nino is Scalia's nickname. Walker wrote, "Scalia's opinion suggests that the results I highlighted have sufficiently removed the need for an exclusionary rule to act as a judicial branch watchdog over the police. I have never said or even suggested such a thing. To the contrary, I have argued that the results reinforce the Supreme Court's continuing importance in defining constitutional protections for individual rights and requiring the appropriate remedies for violations, including the exclusion of evidence." The court wasn't finished. In 2011, another 8-1 vote found that police officers may forcibly enter a home without a warrant if exigent circumstances exist, even if police create the exigent circumstance themselves. In the case before the court, an informant had conducted a cocaine buy while working for police in Lexington, Kentucky. The police then followed their suspect into an apartment complex, at which point they lost him. They claimed, however, that while they were there, they smelled marijuana coming from an unrelated apartment. They knocked, and when they heard rustling inside, kicked down the door. Inside, they found marijuana and cocaine. The Kentucky Supreme Court threw out the conviction, writing that in this case, police have created their own exigency and cannot rely on the fear of evidence being destroyed as a justification for a warrantless entry. The U.S. Supreme Court disagreed. Writing for the majority, Justice Samuel Alito found that so long as the police conduct itself is lawful before the exigent circumstances manifest, the subsequent search is legal. The court has a history of assuming good intent on the part of police officers. See the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule. But as the lone dissenter, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg explained, decisions like these can become a how-to guide for cops to undermine the Fourth Amendment. The court today arms the police with a way routinely to dishonor the Fourth Amendment's warrant requirement in drug cases. In lieu of presenting their evidence to a neutral magistrate, police officers may now knock, listen, then break the door down, never mind that they had ample time to obtain a warrant. Things were getting bad in New York City. By 2002, the New York Police Department, NYPD, was conducting over 450 drug raids per month, the vast majority under no-knock warrants. In October 2002, Norman Siegel, former director of the New York Civil Liberties Union, held a press conference to announce that he was representing the victims of three such raids, all of them involving raids on wrong addresses, in a lawsuit against the city. Siegel pleaded with police to use more caution. "We must do a better job of no-knock search warrants," he warned. "Otherwise, someone might wind up dead as a result of how we implement this procedure." Less than a year later, his prediction came to pass. On May 16, 2003, a dozen New York City police officers stormed an apartment building in Harlem on another no-knock warrant. They were acting on a tip from a confidential informant who told them a convicted felon was dealing drugs and guns from the sixth floor. But there was no felon. The only resident in the building was Alberta Spruill, a 57-year-old city employee described by friends as a devout churchgoer. Before breaking in, the raid team set off a flashbang grenade, a non-lethal weapon that emits a bright flash and deafening thud used to shock and disorient criminal suspects, or the enemy, in combat situations. The explosion of bright white light and accompanying thunderous boom stunned Spruill. She fell to the ground. Once the police figured out their mistake, an officer attempted to help Spruill to her feet, but she went limp and slipped into cardiac arrest. She died 2 hours later. The ensuing investigation found that the NYPD's informant had flat-out lied, and that the officers who conducted the raid had done no investigation whatsoever to corroborate the tip. A police source later told the New York Daily News that, in fact, the informant's record was so poor he was due to be dropped from the city's informant list. Yet somehow, an uncorroborated tip from an informant with a prior success rate somewhere around 0% was still enough to get the Manhattan District Attorney's Office and a state magistrate to sign off on a no-knock warrant. The entire process, from the conversation with the informant until the moment Alberta Spruill's heart stopped beating, took only a matter of hours. In an article the following June, the New York Times noted another horribly botched raid on Timothy Brockman, a frail 68-year-old former Marine. The raid was so violent that next-door neighbors, afraid that the building had been bombed by terrorists, fled with their pajama-clad children. The police had the wrong house. Sources interviewed by the paper said the operation was muddled by erroneous information and the belief in a phantom informant. The assault on Brockman's home illustrated not only the ways that aggressive police work can go wrong, but also the willingness or hesitance of the authorities to take responsibility for preventing such errors. At the time, the incident received no publicity and no serious attention from the police leadership. Brockman was raided 2 days before Alberta Spruill. In its own follow-up piece, the Village Voice found that reports of botched no-knocks had been pouring into the NYPD for years. Until Spruill's death, the NYPD had done nothing to stem the number of incidents, the Voice wrote, despite receiving a memo from the Civilian Complaint Review Board in January, noting the high number of raid complaints. Last March, the NAACP also approached NYPD Commissioner Raymond W. Kelly about the raids. The raids were straining already tense relations between police and minority communities. One of the wrongly raided, Orlando Russell, told The Voice that while he had once been an upstanding citizen, he was fed up with the number of no-knock raids on low-income and minority communities. Any cop walking into his home without an invitation better have a body bag. That 1998 New York Times story ran under the headline, "As number of police raids increase, so do questions." The article noted that the number of narcotics search warrants issued in New York City had doubled from 1994 to 1998, from 1,447 to 2,977. And most of these raids, according to the Times, were drug raids done with no-knock warrants. Despite ongoing media reports of wrong-door raids throughout the late 1990s, city officials continued to insist that such incidents were uncommon and nothing to be alarmed about. And yet, in February 1998, the NYPD circulated a memo among the city's police officers instructing them on how to contact locksmiths and door repair services should they break down in the wrong home. Outwardly, the claim was that these were isolated incidents, rare as a lightning strike. Inwardly, the department knew they were common enough that officials had established procedures for fixing wrongly raided doors. Though complaints about botched raids came in regularly, the city's Civilian Complaint Review Board, CCRB, could do little to stop them. The board was hamstrung by bureaucracy, limited jurisdiction, and antagonism from the police union. The review board was only permitted to review cases in which the raiding cops themselves had acted improperly. It couldn't look at the substance of an individual warrant to determine, for example, if it was proper for a judge to have issued it in the first place. The board also couldn't give victims the information they needed to seek compensation, or even an official apology and admission of error, which some needed to appease landlords or employers who were unpersuaded by their protestations of innocence. And so, as the number of no-knock raids in New York City soared, NYPD officials would tell victims that their only recourse was the CCRB, knowing full well that there was little the CCRB could actually do. With its jurisdiction limited to the conduct of police in specific raids after the warrant was issued, the review board not only was unable to investigate whether a raid should ever have been conducted in the first place, it also couldn't look into the use and abuse of informants, whether the same cops were conducting too many raids, or whether the same raid teams were making the same mistakes. In 2003, Police Chief Raymond Kelly estimated that at least 10% of the city's more than 450 monthly no-knock drug raids were served on the wrong address, were served under bad information, or otherwise didn't produce enough evidence for an arrest. Incredibly, Kelly made that estimate in defense of the way the NYPD was handling these raids. Some 45 times per month, innocent New Yorkers were getting raided, terrorized, sometimes injured, and nearly killed. Police officials would argue that in a significant percentage of cases where a raid came up empty, the suspects weren't actually innocent. They were just successful at moving their stash before police could serve the warrant. And the city's police chief found that figure acceptable. It was just more collateral damage. Kelly also admitted that the NYPD didn't keep track of botched raids, leading one city council member to speculate that the percentage could be even higher. So what about the city's judges, the public servants charged with protecting the Fourth Amendment? Newsday found that many courts in the city didn't even keep no-knock warrants on file after they were issued and executed. That is, not only did the courts not notice or care about what was happening, but they made it impossible for anyone else to investigate possible patterns of abuse. The paper reported that Judge Juanita Bing Newton, who oversaw all the city's criminal courts at the time, said she doesn't necessarily believe the court's role in record-keeping is as a big brother to check the police and district attorney, a statement that not only showed an astonishing lack of concern for the rights of New Yorkers, but suggests that Newton didn't actually know the origin of the phrase big brother. After Spruill's death, New York State Supreme Court Judge Brenda Soloff refused to unseal the affidavit and search warrant authorizing the raid. There was no significant need, she found. Apparently, the death of an innocent 57-year-old woman and the city government's regular terrorization of its citizens weren't significant concerns. In favor of keeping the documents sealed, Soloff cited concern for the safety of the confidential informant, the same informant who had given nothing but bad information in the past, and whose tip was the reason an innocent woman was dead. The concern wasn't valid anyway. The documents could have been released with the informant's identity redacted. A day after the New York City Council held hearings on no-knock raids in response to Spruill's death, Manhattan Borough President Virginia Fields held hearings of her own. According to the Village Voice, dozens of Black and Latino victims, nurses, secretaries, and former officers, packed her chambers airing tales, one more horrifying than the next. Most were unable to hold back tears as they described police ransacking their homes, handcuffing children and grandparents, putting guns to their heads, and being verbally and often physically abusive. In many cases, victims had received no follow-up from the NYPD, even to fix busted doors or other physical damage. Some complainants reported that they had filed grievances with the Civilian Complaint Review Board and were told there was no police misconduct. Unless there is proven abuse, the CCRB disregards complaints about warrants that hold a correct address but are faulty because of bad evidence from a confidential informant. Perhaps no one was more victimized by the battlefield mentality that had set in at the NYPD than Walter and Rose Martin. The Brooklyn couple, both in their 80s, were wrongly raided more than 50 times between 2002 and 2010. The couple filed numerous complaints with the police department. They wrote letters to Mayor Michael Bloomberg and NYPD Commissioner Ray Kelly. They were ignored. In 2007, they at least got someone at the NYPD to try to wipe their address out of the department's computer system. But the raids continued. It wasn't until the couple went to the media in 2010 that the city finally looked into the problem. Back in 2002, someone had used the Martins' address as a dummy address to test the department's new computer system. When the new system was implemented, no one removed their address. So any time NYPD cops in certain precincts used the system for a warrant and forgot to remove the dummy address to put in the correct one, the police would end up at the Martins' door. At least, that was the official explanation. But the New York Daily News tracked down the previous owner of the house, who said he too had been frequently visited by cops, going back to 1994. It seems safe to say that NYPD cops weren't repeatedly terrorizing an elderly couple deliberately. But the Martins' inability to stop the raids until they went to the media is more evidence that even after the Spruill incident, the department just wasn't all that concerned about mistaken raids and the rights of New Yorkers. They should have listened to us all those years when we tried to tell them something was happening, Rose Martin told the Daily News. That was certainly true in her case. It was also true of the dozens, probably hundreds, of complaints from victims going back to the early 1990s. Despite public outcry, intense media coverage, and promises for reform by public officials, change after Alberta Spruill's death was slow and sparse. The key recommendation from the Fields report was that the NYPD produce an annual report detailing all statistics regarding the execution of warrants. Fields believed that such a report would provide some transparency and accountability in the issuance and execution of drug warrants, particularly those authorizing no-knock raids. The NYPD issued no such report in 2005. There were a few positive developments. The city did implement some procedures that increased the amount of time it takes to obtain a drug raid warrant from 2 to 24 hours. Consequently, the total number of drug raids did drop from 5,117 in 2002 to 3,577 in 2003. That decrease isn't insignificant, but the post-reform figure in 2003 was still 250% higher than the number of annual raids just 10 years earlier. Judges and police were also required to attend training workshops on proper drug investigation techniques and the issuance of narcotics warrants. The city also restricted the use of flashbang grenades and finally prohibited them completely in 2010. It would be hard to come up with a more sympathetic drug raid victim than Alberta Spruill, but even after her death, after the revelation of dozens of similar botched raids, after intense media exposure in the country's largest city, and after promises for substantive reforms to prevent similar incidents from happening again, it wasn't long before drug policing in the city returned to business as usual, and the mistaken raids started up again. By 2006, the number of citizen complaints about residential search warrant raids had swelled to 1,065, a 49% jump over 2002, the year before the Spruill raid. If it couldn't happen in New York City after this incident, real reform would be a long, tough slog, if it was possible at all. Just before the federal assault weapons ban was set to expire in 2004, the National Institute for Justice released a study looking at the use of assault weapons in violent crimes. Drawing on crime data from several American cities, the report found that assault weapons were rarely used in gun crimes, even before the ban was put in place. Moreover, because assault weapons are so rarely used by criminals, NIJ found that, should it be renewed, the ban's effects on gun violence were likely small at best, and perhaps too small for reliable measurement. The report also found that the use of such high-powered weaponry to kill police officers was very rare. The NIJ study was used by gun rights groups to argue against renewing the assault weapons ban. But it was also a strong piece of evidence undercutting the common argument from law enforcement officials that SWAT teams and military gear were essential because the police were in a non-stop arms race with drug dealers and other criminals. Call it the North Hollywood shootout argument. And in fact, the 2004 NIJ study was only the most recent to cut against that argument. In 1995, the Justice Department had released a study showing that 86% of violent gun crimes in the United States involved a handgun. The most popular weapon used in homicides at the time wasn't an automatic weapon, but a large-caliber revolver. Just 3% of murders in 1993 were committed with rifles, and just 5% with shotguns. A 1997 Palm Beach Post investigation of area SWAT raids found that of 309 recent arrests made by the 12 SWAT teams in Palm Beach County, Florida, only 60, or 19%, produced weapons of any kind. A 5-year investigation in Orange County, Florida, in the mid-1990s, likewise found that just 13% of SWAT raids turned up weapons. In 2007, I asked David Doddridge, a retired narcotics cop and LAPD veteran, about the argument that SWAT tactics are necessary because drug dealers are increasingly well-armed. "It just isn't true," he said. "In 21 years at LAPD, I never once saw any assault weapons on a drug raid. Drug dealers prefer handguns, which are easier to conceal. Occasionally you'll find a shotgun. But having a bunch of high-powered weaponry around is just too much trouble for them. It's too much for them to worry about." Doddridge's experience isn't universal, but it is common among drug cops I've talked to. There do seem to be more higher-powered arms around the border, and obviously, cops who investigate the sale and smuggling of illegal guns will tend to find a greater quantity of more powerful weapons in the course of their work. But even when the crime rate was peaking in the late 1980s and early 1990s, there was little evidence that murderers were using high-powered weapons. In a 1991 paper for the Independence Institute, a libertarian think tank, researchers David Koppel and Eric Morgan ran a survey of dozens of American cities and found that, in general, fewer than 1% of the weapons seized by police fit the definition of an assault weapon. Nationally, they found that fewer than 4% of homicides involve rifles of any kind, and fewer than 1/8 of 1% of homicides involved weapons of military caliber. Even fewer homicides involved weapons commonly called assault weapons. The proportion of police fatalities caused by assault weapons was around 3%, a number that remained relatively constant throughout the 1980s. Koppel and Morgan also interviewed police firearms examiners. In Dade County, Florida, where Miami Vice had propagated the image of machine gun-toting drug dealers spraying bullets all over the city, Koppel and Morgan found that the use of assault weapons in shootings and homicides in the city actually declined throughout the decade. A police lieutenant in Washington, D.C., the most violent city in the country at the time, told the authors that the preferred weapon of criminals in the nation's capital was the pistol. But more generally, the argument that well-armed criminals have made cops' jobs more dangerous than ever just isn't backed up by the data. The job of police officer has been getting progressively safer for a generation. The number of officer fatalities peaked in 1974 and has been steadily dropping since. In fact, 2012 was the safest year for police officers since the 1950s. According to the FBI's Uniform Crime Reports, the homicide rate for police officers in 2010, the last year for which data is available, was about 7.9 per 100,000 officers. That's about 60% higher than the overall homicide rate in America, which is 4.8. But it's lower than the homicide rates in many large cities, including Atlanta, 17.3, Boston, 11.3, Dallas, 11.3, Kansas City, 21.1, Nashville, 8.9, Pittsburgh, 17.3, St. Louis, 40.5, and Tulsa, 13.7. In fact, of the 74 U.S. cities with populations of 250,000 or more, 36 have murder rates higher than that of police in America. You're more likely to be murdered just by living in these cities than the average American police officer is to be murdered on the job. Proponents of police militarization will argue that these figures show that militarization is working. It's making cops safer. It's a convenient way to frame the debate. If police fatalities go up, it's an indication that criminals are getting more dangerous and cops need more firepower. If police fatalities go down, it means militarization is working. But it's far from clear that bigger guns and more aggressive tactics are responsible for the drop. For example, assaults on police officers have also been dropping, a statistic that isn't explained by cops in SWAT gear performing more drug raids. The most likely explanation is that killings of police officers have declined for the same reasons the overall crime rate has dropped over roughly the same period. Criminologists are still fighting over what those reasons are. The more important questions are why these myths persist and what effect they have on the way police officers approach the job. As for why the myths persist, one explanation is that the public rarely takes an optimistic view of crime and public safety. For example, polls still consistently show that most Americans think crime in the country is getting worse, even though, as noted, it has been dropping quite dramatically for nearly 20 years. But law enforcement officials themselves help perpetuate the perception that cops' jobs are fraught with peril. At the end of every calendar year, the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund puts out the police mortality figures for the year about to end. The figures always generate a good amount of media coverage. But whether the figures are up or down, the quotes in these stories from the law enforcement community are always the same. They always stress that police officers have incredibly dangerous jobs, and that every cop's next day on the job could be his last. But from the figures above, that's like saying every day a Bostonian spends in Boston could be his last. Technically, both statements are true. But they convey a false sentiment about risk. The problem is that there are plenty of incentives for law enforcement leaders to play up the risks to the job. It moves the public debate over issues like militarization, police discretion, use of force, and police budgets more in their favor. The heavily armed criminals angle also tends to find favor with gun control advocates in the media. But playing up the risks and dangers of the job, even in spite of overwhelming evidence that things are getting better, almost certainly has an impact on the mindset of the average cop. If you approach the job as if every day could be your last, you're going to approach every citizen encounter as if it could be your last. That makes everyone a potential enemy. The job becomes about survival, not public service. Hence, the unofficial motto of the job you often hear from cops or see posted on police discussion boards: whatever I need to do to get home safe at the end of the day. In a 2006 op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, written in reaction to the killing of 23-year-old Sean Bell, who went down in a storm of 50 bullets fired by NYPD cops, Joseph McNamara looked at the gradual change in the average cop's mindset since he walked a beat in New York. Simply put, the police culture in our country has changed. An emphasis on officer safety and paramilitary training pervades today's policing, in contrast to the older culture, which held that cops didn't shoot until they were about to be shot or stabbed. Police in large cities formerly carried revolvers holding six 38 caliber rounds. Nowadays, police carry semi-automatic pistols with 16 high-caliber rounds, shotguns, and military assault rifles, weapons once relegated to SWAT teams facing extraordinary circumstances. Concern about such firepower in densely populated areas hitting innocent citizens has given way to an attitude that the police are fighting a war against drugs and crime and must be heavily armed. Yes, police work is dangerous, and the police see a lot of violence. On the other hand, 51 officers were slain in the line of duty last year, out of some 700,000 to 800,000 American cops. That is far fewer than the police fatalities occurring when I patrolled New York's highest crime precincts, when the total number of cops in the country was half that of today. Each of these police deaths and numerous other police injuries is a tragedy, and we owe support to those who protect us. On the other hand, this isn't Iraq. The need to give our officers what they require to protect themselves and us has to be balanced against the fact that the fundamental duty of the police is to protect human life, and that law officers are only justified in taking a life as a last resort. On the other side, it's difficult to even get an estimate of the number of times police officers shoot citizens. Some states require police departments to keep those figures, but national data is difficult to come by. The New York Times reported in 2001, despite widespread public interest and a provision in the 1994 Crime Control Act requiring the Attorney General to collect the data and publish an annual report on them, statistics on police shootings and use of non-deadly force continue to be piecemeal products of spotty collection and are dependent on the cooperation of local police departments. The paper added, no comprehensive accounting for all the nation's 17,000 police departments exists. University of South Carolina criminology professor Jeffrey Alpert called the lack of reporting a national scandal, adding, these are public servants who work for us and are paid to protect us. The Las Vegas Review-Journal also looked for national figures for its 2011 series on a rise in local police-involved shootings. Little had changed since the New York Times report a decade earlier. The nation's leading law enforcement agency collects vast amounts of information on crime nationwide, but missing from this clearinghouse are statistics on where, how often, and under what circumstances police use deadly force. In fact, no one anywhere comprehensively tracks the most significant act police can do in the line of duty: take a life. We don't have a mandate to do that, said William Carr, an FBI spokesman in Washington, D.C. It would take a request from Congress for us to collect that data. Congress, it seems, hasn't asked. Americans, then, both police officers and others, are regularly reminded about the inherent danger faced by police officers, even though the job is getting safer. But not only aren't figures about how many times cops shoot at, injure, or kill citizens publicized, the figures themselves haven't been tabulated. The federal government has been arming American cops with military-grade guns, vehicles, and other weaponry, but has little interest in knowing if all of that is affecting how and when police use lethal force against American citizens. Cops are told all the time that the public presents a threat to them, and that the threat grows more dire by the day. But as for what sort of threat cops pose to the public isn't permitted to know. These policies have given us an increasingly armed, increasingly isolated, increasingly paranoid, increasingly aggressive police force in America, and a public shielded from knowing the consequences of it all. The explosion happened without warning around 4 a.m. in Westchester, Pennsylvania. FBI agent Donald Bain was sitting in his car in a parking lot with two other agents. He was armed and wore a Kevlar vest. He was also carrying a flashbang grenade, a non-lethal weapon that emits a bright flash and deafening bang that's used to shock and disorient criminal suspects or the enemy in combat situations. The three agents, Bain, Thomas Scanzano, and James Milligan, were waiting for developments in a kidnapping that had turned into a hostage stakeout. That's when, Bain says, the flashbang grenade in his vest just blew up. "The car is on fire," Bain recalled. "I was told later I was on fire. Smoke billowing in the car. It was obviously chaos." That was the introduction to a 2008 CNN report about an incident that happened in 2004. The federal government subsequently issued criminal indictments against Pyrotechnic Specialties Incorporated, PSI, alleging that the company knew that its flashbang grenades were defective, but continued to sell them to the federal government anyway. CNN also interviewed Dean Wagner, a U.S. Army sergeant who lost a hand in Iraq when a flashbang grenade prematurely detonated as he was holding it. "They don't have a clue what it's like," Wagner told the network, referring to PSI. "If they could experience that, or someone close to them would have to go through that experience, I'm sure it would be a different story, and maybe they wouldn't have allowed it to happen." A few years later, in February 2011, Fred Thornton, a member of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg SWAT team, was killed when a flashbang grenade went off as he was organizing his SWAT gear in his garage. The next month, in Alice, Texas, SWAT Commander Richard DeLeon was critically injured when a flashbang grenade went off as he was putting gear into his car. And in 2001, an FBI agent in Buffalo, New York, was burned on his hands and upper body when a flashbang grenade went off unexpectedly. These incidents are tragic and unfortunate, but they're also rather chilling. Every day, SWAT teams across the country use the very same explosives that injured agents Bain, Scanzano, Milligan, and killed Officer Thornton, and they use them against American citizens. Granted, they aren't deployed in quite as tight an area as an enclosed car, but garages, certainly. Also bedrooms, kitchens, hallways, and living rooms. This could be perhaps justified if the devices were only used against people actively taking hostages or robbing a bank, or violent fugitives on the run. But the vast majority of the time, they're used in the service of warrants for nonviolent crimes, and not even against people convicted of those crimes, but people merely suspected of them. They're also used against anyone else who happens to be in the house at the time of the raid, and against the victims of wrongdoer raids. Clay Conrad, a criminal defense attorney in Houston, has argued that flashbang grenades are unconstitutional because, by design, they're intended to inflict injury on people who have yet to even be charged with a crime, much less convicted of one. "It's just an assault," Conrad told me in a 2010 interview. "These things are designed to blind and deafen. They produce a shockwave of 136 decibels or more. You're intentionally injuring people." Conrad once mounted a challenge to flashbang grenades in a drug case based on a Texas law that prevents evidence from being admitted in trial if the police commit a crime while obtaining it. He argued in a brief that the use of flashbangs during drug raids constitutes a criminal assault. Conrad says that the prosecution offered a generous plea before that issue could be hashed out in court. "We were prepared to argue that if these things are as harmless as the state claims, we should be able to detonate one in the courtroom," Conrad says. That would have been fun. Of course, it could also be argued that nearly everything about these raids inflicts punishment on people who have yet to be charged with a crime. The same year the CNN story came out, a state judge in New Jersey tossed the conviction of a man suspected of dealing meth because police used flashbang grenades and paramilitary tactics to serve the warrant, including waking a 17-year-old, who was not the suspect, by pointing their guns at him. This was a commando raid-like scenario, Superior Court Judge James J. Morley said, and my decision was based on the overall way they approached the case. At 5 a.m., with 29 police officers in commando gear and pointing a weapon at a sleeping 17-year-old. The argument is that it shocks the conscience, Conrad said. That argument has some validity to it in the right cases, where you're using these volatile tactics against someone who's suspected of nothing more than drug dealing. It's excessive to the point of violating the Fourth Amendment. The CNN report called flashbang grenades non-lethal, but that term only refers to the officer's intent when using them. It doesn't mean the devices can't kill, as the families of Officer Thornton and Alberta Spruill would attest. More recently, in late 2012, a 12-year-old Montana girl suffered severe burns after police on a drug raid tossed a flashbang grenade through her window. The following month, the city of St. Paul, Minnesota, paid out a $400,000 settlement to a woman set on fire by a flashbang grenade thrown by police during a drug raid. Fires aren't uncommon. In 1994, a flashbang grenade detonated during a raid in Dallas burned the surrounding building to the ground, leaving 15 people homeless. In 2001, a flashbang deployed during a raid on a Florida house that was home to a small record label ignited the foam rubber put in the walls for soundproofing. The fire destroyed the studio's master recordings and $100,000 worth of equipment. Sergeant Gary Robbins said afterward, "It's unfortunate those guys packed that house with materials that were flammable." In 1996, a SWAT team in Fitchburg, Massachusetts, population 39,102, burned down an entire apartment complex with a flashbang they used during a drug raid. 6 police officers were injured, and 24 people were left homeless. Several of the officers were later cited for bravery. More recently, police in San Antonio rendered a home a total loss when, on a drug raid, they tossed a flashbang grenade that ignited a mattress, which then set the rest of the house aflame. There are other problems with the use of flashbang grenades beyond their potential to inflict injuries and start fires. By design, the devices are intended to confuse, stun, and bewilder everyone in the room where they're detonated. That may make sense if you're apprehending a suspect who poses an immediate threat to other people. Again, bank robbers, hostage takers, active shooters, and so on. But in raids for nonviolent offenses, sowing confusion only increases the potential for violence. On numerous occasions, police have detonated a flashbang grenade in the course of a raid, then claimed that a suspect who subsequently grabbed a gun or a knife, or who physically attacked one of the officers, should have known that it was the police raiding the home. But you can't first claim that the use of flashbang grenades to stun and confuse people is critically important, then claim that seconds after the device goes off, those same people, many of whom have also just woken up, should be cognizant, collected, and alert enough to make sense of the chaos around them. Well, you can't logically make both claims. In practice, police make both claims all the time. Courts and public officials rarely question the contradiction. The fact that flashbang grenades are usually detonated before, during, or just after the police break down a door creates yet more problems. Sometimes they're tossed through a window before the door comes down, or detonated shortly after police make an announcement, but before they force entry. The whole psychological philosophy behind them is contradictory, says Joseph McNamara, the former police chief of Kansas City and San Jose. Knock and announce is to give the person inside time to voluntarily surrender. When you're waiting just 15 seconds, setting off flash grenades, then using a battering ram, you're diverting attention from the front door. You're scaring people into running in the other direction. It also decreases the likelihood that the occupants inside will recognize the armed intruders as police officers. In 2006, a Florida state appeals court found that a SWAT team had violated a man's Fourth Amendment rights because although they waited 15 seconds after announcing before forcing entry, the officers began counting only after detonating a flashbang grenade, and included in their count the time they spent bashing the door with a battering ram. But only a few other courts have either questioned the use of flashbang grenades or put restrictions on their use, and even then, only in limited circumstances. Generally speaking, the courts give police an enormous amount of leeway in deciding how to serve a search warrant. Even in the rare case when a court has found that the use of the grenades was unreasonable and therefore a violation of a plaintiff's constitutional rights, the same court inevitably finds that the police officers are protected by qualified immunity, which means that the person injured by the grenade won't even get his case in front of a jury. In 2004, for example, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit found that blindly tossing a flashbang grenade into a house or room with no certainty as to who and how many people might have been inside was unreasonable. But because it wasn't so unreasonable as to be established law or obvious to a layperson, the officers in that case still couldn't be held liable. The flashbang grenade issue has never been of much interest to politicians either. During congressional hearings on the Branch Davidian raid, Democratic Representative Charles Schumer of New York asked Dick DeGuerin, an attorney for David Koresh, if the Branch Davidians had stockpiled grenades. DeGuerin responded that the only grenades he had seen were thrown by ATF agents. Schumer derisively dismissed the idea that flashbang grenades were harmful. Mr. DeGuerin said, "Flashbangers can kill, injure, maim." Schumer said, "Anyone who knows anything about these things knows they can't." Schumer went on to win a U.S. Senate seat in 1998, which means that when New York City resident Alberta Spruill died from the effects of a flashbang grenade in 2003, she was one of Schumer's constituents. Saul Colosi is dead because he bet on a football game, but it wasn't a bookie or a loan shark who killed him. His local government killed him, ostensibly to protect him from his gambling habit. 7 months earlier, at a local bar, Fairfax County, Virginia detective David Balcom overheard the 38-year-old optometrist and some friends wagering on a college football game. To Sal, betting a few bills on the Redskins was a stress reliever, done among friends, a friend of Colosi's told me shortly after his death. None of us single, successful professionals ever thought that betting $50 or so on the Virginia Tech football game was a crime worthy of investigation. Balcom apparently did. After overhearing the men wagering, Balcom befriended Colosi as a cover to begin investigating him. During the next several months, he talked Colosi into raising the stakes of what Colosi thought were just more fun wagers between friends to make watching sports more interesting. Eventually, Colosi and Balcom bet more than $2,000 in a single day. Under Virginia law, that was enough for police to charge Colosi with running a gambling operation. And that's when they brought in the SWAT team. On the night of January 24, 2006, Balcom called Colosi and arranged a time to drop by to collect his winnings. When Colosi, barefoot and clad in a t-shirt and jeans, stepped out of his house to meet the man he thought was a friend, the SWAT team began to move in. Seconds later, Detective Deval Bullock, who had been on duty since 4 a.m. and hadn't slept in 17 hours, fired a bullet that pierced Colosi's heart. Saul Colosi's last words were to Balcom, the cop he thought was a friend. "Dude, what are you doing?" In March 2006, just 2 months after its ridiculous gambling investigation resulted in the death of an unarmed man, the Fairfax County Police Department issued a press release warning residents not to participate in office betting pools tied to the NCAA men's basketball tournament. The title, "Illegal Gambling Not Worth the Risk." Given the proximity to Colosi's death, residents could be forgiven for thinking the police department believed wagering on sports was a crime punishable by execution. In January 2011, the Colosi family accepted a $2 million settlement offer from Fairfax County. That same year, Virginia's government spent $20 million promoting the state lottery. The raid on Saul Colosi was merely another red flag indicating yet more SWAT team mission creep in America. It wasn't even the first time a Virginia SWAT team had killed someone during a gambling raid. In 1998, a SWAT team in Virginia Beach shot and killed security guard Edward C. Reed during a 3 a.m. raid on a private club suspected of facilitating gambling. Police said they approached the tinted car where Reed was working security, knocked, and identified themselves, then shot Reed when he refused to drop his handgun. Reed's family insisted the police story was unlikely. Reed had no criminal record. Why would he knowingly point his gun at a heavily armed police team? More likely, they said, Reed mistakenly believed the raiding officers were there to do harm, particularly given that the club had been robbed not long before the raid. Statements by the police themselves seemed to back that account. According to officers at the scene, Reed's last words were, "Why did you shoot me? I was reading a book." As the Texas Hold'em craze picked up momentum in the mid-2000s, fans of the game started hosting tournaments at private clubs, bars, and residences. Police in many parts of the country responded with SWAT raids. In 2011, for example, police in Baltimore County, Maryland, sent a tactical unit to raid a $65 buy-in poker game at the Lynch Point Social Club. From 2006 to 2008, SWAT teams in South Carolina staged a number of raids to break up poker games in the suburbs of Charleston. Some were well-organized and high stakes, but others were friendly games with a $20 buy-in. The typical police raid of these games is to literally burst into a home in SWAT gear with guns drawn and treat poker players like a bunch of high-level drug dealers, an attorney representing poker players told a local newspaper. Using the taxpayers' resources for such useless Gestapo-like tactics is more of a crime than is playing of the game. In 2007, a Dallas SWAT team actually raided a Veterans of Foreign Wars outpost for hosting charity poker games. Players said the tactics were terrifying. One woman urinated on herself. When police raided a San Mateo, California poker game in 2008, card players described cops storming the place in full riot gear and with guns drawn. The games had buy-ins ranging from $25 to $55. Under California law, the games were legal, so long as no one took a rake or a cut of the stakes. No one had, but the police claimed the $5 the hosts charged players to buy refreshments qualified as a rake. In March 2007, a small army of local cops, ATF agents, National Guard troops, and a helicopter raided a poker game in Cary, North Carolina. They issued 41 citations, all of them misdemeanors. A columnist at the Fayetteville Observer remarked, "They were there to play cards, not to foment."